Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
I'm Dr. Angela Coombs.
And I'm Dr. Jen Sotsky. You're listening to Psych Pearls, a collaboration between Psychiatric Times and the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry.
We are two early career psychiatrists grappling with the most pressing issues in mental health today, both inside and outside of the office, with the help of our guest experts. Today, we are grateful to host a special part one of a two-part series on the impact of COVID on physicians and the patients they serve. We are honored to have our guests, Dr. David Chong and Dr. Sarah Nash.
Dr. Chong is a former program director for the internal medicine program and former intensive care unit director at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Nash is a consultation liaison psychiatrist and fellowship director. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for being here with us today. So we are hoping to kind of open this session with just asking you, and this is a big question, how did you feel during the first COVID surge, and how does that compare to now? We're about a year out from when it first began.
I'll go first. It was shocking. So my story starts in Ethiopia. So I teach in Ethiopia, and this last year in 2020, I was in a very remote village in northern Ethiopia because I had not done my proper logistics, and it turned out that they had excess faculty at the main center in Addis Ababa. So they said, oh, why don't you come and go to this remote village? I said, sure. So little did I know that it took probably around 24 hours of travel for me to get there. And the minute I got there, I got there on a Sunday, and on that Monday, I think that was March 1st, Columbia got their first COVID patient from Westchester transferred to the ICU at Columbia. And I knew that if I hadn't left, I would get stuck somewhere in some airport, random airport, never being able to get back. So I was there for one day, and then I made arrangements to come back. And by that Friday, I was back in New York. And we were anticipating this huge wave of patients. And for about 2 weeks, there was literally nothing. We got nothing. Between March 1st and March 14th or 15th, I think had zero patients. And we're like, oh, this isn't so bad. And then the third and fourth week happened in March, and the floodgates opened. And all I remember in the first couple of weeks of the pandemic was patients being intubated in the emergency room before ER physicians were even examining them. They would just come in these gurneys. They would be short of breath, statting in the 70s, and they would call this special anesthesia group that was created, and they would just come and intubate everybody. And we created a command center where we were trying to figure out where to put these patients. And we were sending patients to every ICU, and then we had to open these new OR ICUs. And so I would say for the first 3 weeks of the pandemic in late March and early April, we're intubating probably every 45 minutes to an hour for a good 2 weeks. And it was devastating because these patients were not just a little sick. They were basically maxing out on everything we had, on every sedative medicine, on oxygen. We couldn't figure out who was supposed to even see the patients because we were so afraid of if it's lethality. We actually came up with this idea that only attendings were allowed to actually examine the patients. So not only was I triaging patients to go to the ICU when I worked in the ICU for those couple of weeks, I was the only one actually going into the rooms. And we were learning how to put on PPE, take off PPE. Because we didn't ever learn that. We just threw gowns on and threw them off. So it was dizzying. All I remember in the beginning was so many patients, all ages, just coming in short of breath and seeing so much death in the in the first month. And that was something I'll never forget.
I think it was a bit different on my end. You know, my story doesn't start as dramatically, I think, as Dr. Chong's, but I remember being out on a weekend afternoon with my kids and in the first week of March, and feeling the beginning of a sore throat and wondering, what does this mean? And the long story short is, I don't think I actually had COVID, but I had a sore throat and a fever, and you couldn't get tested. And there was a lot of not knowing. And because I had fluctuations in my temperature, very low grade, but enough that I couldn't come back into work. Basically, from the middle of March to the end of March, and even into April, I was home, working from home, checking in with the division. And there was this sense of frustration and helplessness of desperately wanting to do something and feeling very helpless. And at the same time, having this sense of how scary it would be to actually be in the hospital. One of the things that developed was a real organization on the part of our division of consultation liaison psychiatry to try to see where we could be helpful and how we could do it remotely. And so there were opportunities to kind of connect with some of the units, but they were really very busy and overwhelmed and didn't always need our help. So we did some things like reaching out to families of patients who were dying, trying to help in that sense, which was incredibly valuable. And then for me personally, I was very grateful when relatively early in the pandemic, Dr. Baptista asked if I would be willing to be part of this new organization, COPE Columbia, that was being created to help faculty and staff. And so that was incredibly meaningful to be part of something organized where we ran groups for residents, for attendings, for nurses, for physician's assistants. And it was incredibly deeply meaningful. And some of the stories that Dr. Chong is talking about being right on the front lines, we were able to help people process that experience. And I remember having one group with some hospitalists and the description of, we're running out of oxygen in the emergency room. There are no more wall taps for oxygen. There are no more oxygen cylinders. They run out very, very quickly. And just how terrifying it was for people who were trying to keep patients alive. When I came back, there was the opportunity to actually see patients. But at the beginning, for psychiatrists, there weren't patients to see because people were intubated and so sick. And so I think for us, in terms of patients who had COVID, our interactions with them happened a bit later when they started waking up and were tremendously delirious. And that was sort of around May. So I think really April was a lot of work with staff. And in May, we started dealing with patients and ongoing work with staff. But it was definitely a very scary time.
I mean, you both have highlighted sort of the fear within that experience. And I wonder, given both of you all sort of not just, you know, being your human selves, individual clinicians, but in your leadership roles and responsibilities, how did you navigate that fear? And how have those fears sort of shifted and evolved over time now that, you know, we're post 1 year in? Are there different types of fears that you all have now?
One of the fears I had was for my family. It was a very weird time in the beginning. We didn't know anything, and we were so scared that we were watching videos of how to don and doff our PPE. My daughter was basically excused from college, and she came home, and so we had an apartment for her near Columbia, and so I stayed there for 2 weeks. So I didn't come home for 2 weeks while I was taking care of patients because I was afraid of bringing COVID back home. And then after about 2 weeks, I couldn't sleep. I mean, I was just dying. So I decided that we would come up with a system where I would sleep downstairs and a shower when I came in, and I wouldn't be near anybody. I would mask up for a while I was home. So I think one was that there was a personal fear of bringing, not so much myself, and I think there was a little bit of fear that I would get sick, but that I would bring it home. So that's one thing that has changed. I think now that I'm vaccinated and I've seen so many patients and my antibody levels were actually negative. I never got sick from COVID, even though I must have seen about 500 patients. That's really lessened. So realize that it is there, but it's not as powerful as in the front of my consciousness when I see patients about sort of getting infected from them. The other is, you know, I think when it comes to being a leader, and I was running the program then, and I was running the ICUs, is that I think you just have to really, I mean, there are two options as a leader. I think you either flee or you run toward the emergency. And I think my initial response was to run toward. And I think I just decided to, and we as an institution decided that the attendings would see the patients. So all the consultants, the only patient contact initially was actually the students couldn't see them and the residents couldn't see them initial contact. It was actually going to be the attending. Even the intubation teams, they were supposed to be the senior anesthesiologists who had the most experience would be the one intubating. Everyone else was sort of supporting. And so I think we as an institution and me as personally took the lead when it came to patient care for these patients. And I think it was a good thing. And I think over time, my house staff and the other fellows and other residents decided that, you know, that wasn't gonna be sustainable. And so that changed over time. But in the beginning, we were all, the leaders were being the servants. In fact, I'll tell you some great stories in the emergency room where, you know, it's hard to recognize anybody because they're all in PPE. And I bumped into the head of ophthalmology and the head of urology, transporting patients and drawing blood. And they would introduce me, you know, I was like, who is that? It's like, oh, well, that's the head of urology. He's drawing blood. Because they were doing nothing. They basically canceled all the elective cases. And so all the orthopedists and all the urologists and ophthalmologists were actually trying to figure out ways to support the medical staff and to take care of these patients. And so I think two things happened. One was there was this inherent fear of getting sick and not being able to help. And the other was this constant trying to figure out what to do. And I think it really separated people that sort of the fight or flight instinct. It really, you knew who was there because they were there. They were next to you taking care of these patients. And then the people that were afraid or a little bit older or felt like their clinical skills weren't as useful were not around, but doing other things, supportive things for the house staff and for the patients. And we had residents who were actually, in the beginning, we had our pregnant residents or residents who had underlying conditions work from home. They would do like HMPs, they would help with data gathering, and they would help with calling outpatients and things like that. So we tried to figure out ways that everyone could participate, whether they were in the front lines or not.
Dr. Chong, one of my most vivid memories of the hospital from that period of time was when I briefly filled in for some shifts for a pop-up ICU, and I remember you served us dinner every night.
Yes. So I have to mention that one of the heroes during that time was my wife. So my wife is she's a music teacher, and you can imagine being a music teacher during a pandemic is a very strange thing. So she had to go completely virtual, which was very difficult for her. But she was also very connected to the community and realized all these restaurants that we loved were closed. So she got on her Facebook page and we started a GoFundMe page to gather money to buy food from local vendors. And she would have this supply of local restaurants. And then she would order 100 meals. And then basically we would deliver she would come and I would meet her. So even if I was on service or not, I would meet her for dinner, and I would basically hand out all the meals physically to my house staff. And then we had lots of extra. So I gave them to whoever was filling in on the floors, and I gave them to the security guards, and I got to know the housekeeping people, and every subspecialty that participated in psychiatry was a lifesaver. Dermatology and psychiatry were COVID heroes. I don't think people understood how much medicine psychiatry and dermatology came to do, but they were doing psychiatry or dermatology, but they were doing COVID treatment, and they were fantastic. And I remember, Jen, I remember meeting you, and it's hard because everyone's wearing a mask. So it's very hard to know who's who. And so I just assumed everyone was medicine. And then I realized that that's actually not true. And, you know, my wife was really good about getting actually really good food. And so we tallied it up. She got up $150,000 she raised over that 6 month period. And I physically handed out 65 straight days of meals. So I thought it was really important for me to not just, you know, leave it somewhere, but to actually physically hand it over. And my wife always said things like, you know, you shouldn't forget about the night crew. So then I would leave food for the night crew as well. But I felt that it was really important, especially for my residents, for them to see me physically taking care of them. And I would ask them questions about how the day was going and if there's anything that I could do for them. And so they actually saw me for at least 65 days straight. It was a little bit longer, but for the meals, it was 65 days. And I still get, you know, little comments and texts about people remembering that time of me sort of getting to know them. I got to meet a lot of people outside of medicine as well as my house staff. And I'm glad that I was able to feed you, Jen. But just it was that's like my, that's my wife takes, I gave my wife all the credit for that. It was just her idea. And I was just a delivery guy.
I think, you know, you said an interesting thing, which was seeing people in masks and this sense of, you know, not everybody was medicine. But I think that, you know, after 9/11, everyone was a New Yorker. I think during COVID, everyone was in medicine, whether it was internal medicine or medicine as a greater field. And that was one of the things that I think was most special and kind of got people through it, was this incredible sense of teamwork, that we were all together. We were all doing whatever piece of the work we could do to make things work well for patients and to get each other through. And I've never seen anything like that in the course of my career to date, this just incredible sense of togetherness. And I do a lot of work with internal medicine residents and wellness for internal medicine residents. And in many, many conversations with individual residents, that idea gets really put forward again and again, how wonderful it was to work with all the people who came out from their various other programs to support medicine. And what friendships got forged. And then sort of on the other sense of it, wow, now I know a dermatologist I'm going to refer to. Now I know who to call in orthopedics. Now I know, you know, who's going to be there from whatever other service it was. And this sense of constantly learning and working together. That's something that I think is a little different in the second surge, when we sort of had COVID happening, but also attempting to some degree of life as normal and people doing their own work.
It took a pandemic to get that level of cooperation. It was just absolutely incredible. Everyone, I felt like a rock star, because, you know, medicine is always sort of not the highest specialty in some ways. And I feel like you're right. Everyone became a medical provider, and it was amazing. And people would ask me questions about medicine, and it's nothing like I've ever experienced before. The amount of cooperation, the amount of just no questions asked, people just do things. It was quite remarkable.
It sounds like that sense of togetherness helped you both kind of get through this really difficult experience. Is there anything else you would say about kind of what keeps you going through all the stress?
I think COVID humbles us. I think that in medicine, we become very haughty and we think that we have an answer to a lot of things. I don't know if psychiatrists have a more humble perspective about what they can fix and what they can't fix, but I think we got to the point where we thought in medicine that we could fix everything. And in pulmonary and critical care, I love critical care because most of the patients, no matter how sick they are, they actually get better. There's a small percentage of patients that get worse. And COVID was basically something where most of the patients did very poorly, actually. It kind of flipped. And it basically humbles you to realize that we have tremendous limitations in our knowledge and our treatment, and that it's the humanity of what we do. It's the people that we are. It's how we care for people that are just as important as this promise for curing them. Because I think in COVID, a lot of people that got hospitalized, that got really sick, died. I would say the vast majority of them died. And so does that mean that we don't care for them? And I think that we, you know, I always had this phrase with residents always like, well, there's nothing we could do for them. And I always say that you never say that, because I think that gets to the idea that we can cure everything and we can't. And I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that there's so much we don't know and so much we can't cure, but we could always care for people. And I think that they came here to be taken care of, not to be cured necessarily. And we need to take care of ourselves, but we need to make sure that the patients are cared for, whether they live or die. And many of them died. And I think that our job was to care for the families and for the patients as they died. And I think that was devastating to a lot of people, because, I mean, in medicine, we see a lot of death, and even this was a lot for us. But the concept of caring, even though we couldn't do anything or we didn't understand, I think was very, very important to remember. And I think I remember things as devastating, as difficult as they were. I remember them as a period where my humanity and my kindness and my support was just as important as my medical skills. And I think this is why psychiatry taking care of these patients was just as powerful, even more powerful than medicine taking care of these patients or dermatology or surgery. So I think we have to remember that we can't get ahead of ourselves. I know we're smart and we have all this technology, but there's so much we don't know. And I think COVID has really humbled us.
The pandemic really broke down our own barriers, I think, internally, and helped us realize that we're all quite vulnerable and we're all very human, and how important it is to take care of each other. And you had asked about what keeps us going. And I think that sense of community was tremendous. And that happened both within the hospital and outside of the hospital. So within the hospital, like we talked about, people were really working together. Even, you know, as a program director, one of the concerns was, what about my trainees? What about my fellows? I don't want to put them in harm's way. And I was incredibly moved when really both of my fellows volunteered. That we're in a division that has some younger people and some older people. And one of my fellows, I was literally near tears when he came up to me and said, I'm single. I don't have any children. I don't know what's out there, but I want to do it. And you shouldn't send somebody else. And so it was sort of trying to balance the desire to protect trainees with allowing them to do things that were meaningful for them. Things like that were incredibly moving. I was inspired by so many people at the hospital from every level. I remember the first time I went into a room to see a COVID patient, I was really quite terrified. Did I do the PPE right? What do I do? Psychiatrists don't usually touch people, but how close do I need to come to this person? What's going on? And I remember watching the nurse who was in the room finishing up what she was doing and thinking, wow, this person is just incredible. I just have to watch what she's doing and try to channel some of that incredible energy and compassion and not being afraid, or even being afraid, but doing it anyway. So that all came from within the hospital. But you think outside of the hospital, it was incredible also. Hearing people with the 7 o'clock cheer was incredibly uplifting. Also seeing what other people in the community were doing. And this is from the very beginning. I mean, I have a friend who is a scientist and was busy trying to give up lab space if it would be helpful to someone to do what they needed to do. And when the vaccine became available, donating all of her deep freeze freezers to hold vaccine for the site where she was. My synagogue's rabbi volunteered in vaccine trials and tried to encourage people to do that. And he was an incredible leadership figure for me when I was feeling overwhelmed, to be able to know that there were people outside the hospital who wanted to help us. I have to think about other sources of support too. I mean, Dave mentioned his wife. I have to mention my husband, who, you know, had gone into his office, you know, every day for his whole life, and all of a sudden was not only working from home, but managing online school and everything else, and becoming sort of a full-time stay-at-home dad while trying to manage all of the things that he has to do for work. And we were not alone. I mean, everyone was in that kind of position. And I think that as a whole, our society really rallied to say, we're gonna do what we can do to stop this and support the people who are working on the front lines. So just incredibly grateful for the hard work that everybody put in, both inside the hospital and out.
I will say one of the things that really encouraged me during the pandemic was our morning report room. We turned into a PPE closet, a PPE storage area. In the beginning, there was a couple of things. And then one of my residents decided, she said, could I use the address for the morning for the house staff program office? And I'll put your name as the program director and I'll just send this thing out to the internet. And I was like, sure, that's like, maybe we'll get like seven different things. And so she put it out there. Actually, my name is still associated with this this drive. And so we got PPE from all over the country. And I don't know, I took pictures. Actually, the students were so inspirational in terms of what they wanted to do. I got two students to just help me sort PPE. They sorted PPE for a month. We had probably something on the order of 1,000 pieces of every PPE you can think of. And this was when we were kind of short on PPE. And I was just, every time people came into the morning report room, I think they were uplifted by seeing what was in there. People like sent stuff that they had in their garage, their N95s that they had bought like a couple years ago. People sent cash. There are like checks to the hospital and to the program that we couldn't cash. So we put them up on the board, and kids and other organizations drew pictures that we put up. And so they were just littered, the whole room was littered with well-wishers and with PPE. And I don't know, just seeing a lot of PPE made me really happy. Even if some of it just made no sense, they would send like hazmat suits. And I remember one organization sent toothpaste and toothbrushes and hairspray. And we had so many gloves, we actually started giving stuff away. So I actually ended up giving a lot of PPE to the garage guys because they would park my car and we were short on PPE. So a lot of staff didn't have it. So whatever we had extra, I gave to the people that were parking cars and people that were working outside and the custodial staff. So, and we told them they can come and take stuff. So I thought that the morning report room was an amazing thing. I also would concur with Sarah that even though we came up with this idea of having attending see patients, our house staff basically volunteered to do extra shifts to take care of patients, to cover for people that couldn't cover. And people were just asking to do more, including the students. And so they were an inspiration to me. As much as I was trying to help them, their incredible generosity and selflessness was really inspirational and kept me going.
You know, I think both of you all's emphasis on humility is so important. You know, COVID-19 laid bare sort of the vast structural inequalities within our society and some of my most vulnerable patients and sort of all these burdens. And I wonder, in sort of as we, you know, close out, what are the ways in which the past year has changed you? These experiences of not knowing and having to sort of rise to the occasion, stand in the gap for so many. And then, you know, what are the things that you actually want to remember from this time and want your colleagues or patients or community to remember?
I think it's really helped me to be able to prioritize what's important in my life and to really think about, from a personal level, both to prioritize what's important to me and value it, and to be more cognizant of all of the inequalities that you're mentioning and our efforts to try to combat that. One of the things that, you know, we were talking about fears, it was not just a fear of bringing home illness myself and to my family at home, but I was very, very terrified about my parents who are older, and sort of recognizing the importance of my family at all levels, and also being grateful. I can't really think of another thing that I was as grateful for as the vaccine, and being in a room where, you know, you're being injected. I am not someone who has ever looked forward to a shot in my life, and going to get the vaccine and feeling myself start to cry with gratitude and relief and looking around and seeing I was not alone. It's just this incredible gratitude to everybody, to all the people who participated in taking care of other people, to the scientists who worked tirelessly to try to create the vaccine, for our families, and you know, the work is, there's work left to be done. I mean, and you know, the country has gone through so much in the past year. There's the pandemic, that's the viral pandemic. And then there's the pandemic that's been the racism and inequality and everything else that goes with that pandemic. And I think we've really been forced to confront, like, what are our values and what do we stand for and how can we stand up and really try to make our lives, our world better. And that there is goodness and there are people who are trying to help and that we can do this. And so I'm just incredibly grateful. For having the opportunity to see these things and come out healthy on the other end. And I hope that I'm a better person for it.
I think the pandemic, it's not over. I think it's still going on. I think there are a couple of things that I've realized about this. And I agree with Sarah. I think one is to understand how important your family is and how not important your job is. I've gone through a big transition in my life, and I think that it's really important to remember what's really important. And I think we have to remember how important family is and how important relationships are, and that career and all this other stuff is not as important as essential things about life and death and about the quality of life and about stress and about making sure that people are taken care of. The other thing I think this really highlights is that when we talk about inequalities and we talk about diversity, I think they're almost, we almost talk about them in some sort of theoretical fashion. And it's really not. It's really about life and death. When there are disparities in healthcare, people die. When there are disparities in vaccinations, people die. When there are disparities and when people don't get the care that they need, it's a life and death thing. I think we think of it as something very nice to have an organization that's diverse. Well, in medicine, when you have heterogeneity of care like that, there's a big death, big difference in who lives and who dies. And I think that it drives home the idea that the kind of work that we need to do to bring equity into medicine isn't about it looking nice or your organization being more successful. It's really about life and death. It's about who lives and who dies and whose families get to keep their older loved ones and whose they lose. And I think that it really drives home the idea that the kind of work around diversity and health justice is a really essential part of us being humans and good citizens and helping each other so that we survive, and that your grandparents are just as important as my grandparents. Your parents are as important as anybody else's parents. And your family is just as important as anyone else's family. And I think we have to remember that, you know, we all can't like fly to the Hamptons to escape the pandemic, and that, you know, that we need to make sure that everyone's protected. And that this is the thing that drives me crazy about the vaccine, is that the people that need it most are the people that aren't getting it. And I just hope that we can combat this anti-intellectual sort of wave that's happening, and really tell people how important it is to be vaccinated. And I just hope that that this kind of message really impacts people's lives and not just a political theoretical discussion. It's really about people and their future and living and dying. And I think the pandemic has really sort of highlighted the fact that disparity is not just a theory. It really makes a huge difference in that, not only the quality of life, but the quantity of life.
Yeah. Well, we just want to thank you both, you know, for your service to your patients, your colleagues, trainees, you know, really how you guys have shown up in this season. You know, you didn't ask to do this, right? You know, you couldn't have anticipated this would happen. And we don't know necessarily what the future holds, but we're grateful for the way in which you all show up. So thank you for being with us here today and telling your story. Thank you for listening to Psych Pearls. See you next time.